Good evening and welcome to a public forum hosted by Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, along with a live audience at the WESA-WYEP Community Broadcast Center. Great to have you all with us. The focus of tonight's discussion is the black middle class in this region. While national rankings find the city to be one of the most livable, Pittsburgh is also one of the whitest metropolitan areas in the country. In addition, the Population Studies Center lists Metro Pittsburgh as the 17th most segregated city in the United States. By the way, the five most segregated cities are Milwaukee, Detroit, New York, Chicago, and Cleveland. We've invited our panelists to talk about their experiences as black professionals in Pittsburgh. We'd like to get their thoughts on why there isn't a higher profile of professional African Americans in the city. The forum was inspired by an article written by journalist Ben Schmidt titled "African Americans in Pittsburgh, the Newcomer Experience." We begin tonight's discussion with award-winning journalist Ben Schmidt. Ben, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming down here. First of all, I'd like to ask you, Ben, why did you write this article?
Well, that's a great question. So I grew up in Pittsburgh. I had lived here up until the time I was 18. Moved away, went to Michigan State, and basically, long story short, I had been gone for 22 years. And I worked as a reporter at various places, Atlanta, Detroit for 11 years. And then I came back here to take a marketing job. And when I moved back here, I noticed right away that just going to a restaurant or just going out to any kind of event, it was very white. And coming from a city like Detroit, where you have a much different experience, and also from being in a newsroom, where newsrooms are very diverse in general, it was kind of disconcerting to me. There are four people in this audience that are part of the article. One of them is Evan Frazier. And Evan and I had a very frank discussion, you know, where I just, because I went to high school with Evan, and I just said, hey, what's the deal? Like, how did you decide to stay here? Because I don't know if I was in your shoes that I would have stayed in Pittsburgh. And Evan talked about what a great family town this is, and of course that there are challenges, but that we need to find a way to recruit young black middle-class people, young black professionals, and keep them here. And so that conversation spurred another discussion with an editor at Pittsburgh Quarterly Magazine, who also runs Pittsburgh Today, and he talked about, why don't you do an article and just talk to people who just moved here, you know, in the last 5, 7, 8 years that are black, and get their impressions, and whatever they tell you, just run with it. If it's bad, then it's bad. If it's good, then great. I also included Councilman Lavelle as someone who has been here most of his life, and just to get, you know, his perspective. So one of the first people I interviewed was Marissa Bartley, and I won't talk about where she works, but she told me a story about basically working in a bank. She's a branch manager out in one of the, you know, surrounding communities, not actually in Pittsburgh proper. Long story short, somebody referred to her as the N-word. Is this N-word your boss? And so I'm taking notes, and I'm kind of flustered and like, wow. And I wrote the article up. So a few hours later, Marissa called me back and said, I don't know if I want to put that in there. And I understood that. But we had a discussion. I said, well, I think it's important. I think we need to be honest about this. And in the end, she agreed with me, and we ran with it. But there are stories like that. Just things that you just don't think in 2012, 2013 that people are still dealing with, but they are. And Pittsburgh has this tag of the most livable city, and I love this city, and I want to stay here. I want to, you know, my kids are growing up here. We're happy here, but I don't want it to be those statistics that you just, you know, spouted off, because that's not for me. And I'm getting at the point of my age where I don't have the patience for people who don't agree with me on things like that. I'm just, you know, I'm going to talk about what I believe. I'm going to surround myself with people who agree, and we're going to have conversations like this. And look at this turnout. This is incredible, you know, and I think this is just the start. Where it goes, who knows, but at least we're having the conversation.
I'm curious, Ben, what kind of reaction you got to the fact that you are a white male approaching this subject.
From black people, very positive, encouraging, great. Frankly, from some white people that I know, what are you doing? Why are you worried about this? And I just, you know, I don't have time for that. But the feedback I got from the black community was great. Like, thank you for doing this. Let's keep the conversation going.
Ben, we're glad that you wrote the piece. It certainly has inspired a lot of discussion in this city, including the forum tonight. So, Ben Schmidt, thank you again.
Very much.
And we'll continue on with our discussion. We have a distinguished panel. Esther Bush is president of the Urban League of Pittsburgh. Also with us is Pittsburgh City Councilman R. Daniel Lavelle, who represents District 6, and Candy Castleberry Singleton, Chief Inclusion and Diversity Officer at UPMC. Let's have a round of applause for our panelists. We have lots of questions for you folks. Let's start out with this question, starting with Esther Bush. Esther, how would you assess the current state of Black Pittsburgh?
When you look at Black Pittsburgh right now, even people with college degrees are seriously looking for work and wondering why they cannot find work because they say, I've done all the right things. And as we still walk through corporate America, we do not see African Americans. You don't even see that many in menial jobs, meaning the housekeeping, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you talk about professionals, you'll see one or two. When you talk about management and the executive level, you see fewer and fewer. So when you look at where African Americans are here now, and we're still almost about 25% of the population, it is very clear that Pittsburgh is not a city that has embraced equity, that has embraced the talent that all of its citizens brings, that provides the kind of motivation, interest, and encouragement that would allow people to think, I have a career here. And I'm thinking back because there are, again, so many classes of us. I'm thinking back how I actually try to encourage people to stay here and not overlook their complaints, their concerns, their challenges, but to say, stay here and help us, people like us, fix it. Because until we address it head on, it is not going to get fixed. And I have to include this little story that's going through my mind. A friend that graduated from Westinghouse High School with me was somebody that came back to Pittsburgh because her mother was very sick. And she wanted to be with her mother. Her mother refused to move, et cetera. She was a speech pathologist. She was so pleased she got a position in one of the clinics. And she came to me a few months after she got the job. She said, Esther, you got Pittsburgh. I'm out of here. I said, why? She said, because I cannot help patients that come to me and say they'll wait till the real doctor comes. Now, this is somebody that is living extremely well in Washington, D.C. right now and running back and forth D.C. to Pittsburgh to visit her mother when she could have been working right here. So when we look, the white community, I do not believe, has tried to step forward enough to take a risk, to invest in the talent that they see before them. And when I say take a risk, one thing I found out about Pittsburgh when I came back in 1998, and I remember having this conversation with the then chairman of the board, I said, Pittsburgh is not a high-risk city. The African-American community doesn't take high risk, and the white community doesn't take high risk. And so we all need to get a little more fire up under us and so that we can develop to our fullest extent. And that means stepping out of our comfort zone across the board, socially as well as professionally, so that we can achieve more than we're achieving right now and truly make Pittsburgh a livable city for all of us.
Well, Esther, you certainly raised a lot of important discussion points, and there's some things I want to kind of circle back to, but let's move over to Pittsburgh City Councilman R. Daniel Lavelle. We see a lot of segregated communities in Pittsburgh. Why is that? What do we know about that?
That's actually not my concern, that we are a segregated city. that's not a huge concern of mine, to be quite honest. My larger concern is that within our segregation, our finances, our economics, the disparity within that, I don't have a problem with those who choose to live wherever they so choose to live. If Indians want to live within the Indian community, that doesn't bother me. If there are African Americans who feel most comfortable living around African Americans, that doesn't bother me. And if they want to choose to intentionally sort of segregate themselves, that doesn't bother me. And vice versa, there's those who want to live within an extremely mixed community, as there are. And I represent some of those communities. That doesn't bother me as well. My concern is within the actual structure of those communities. And to get to that, I just want to double back to something Esther had said, which is that Pittsburgh has not embraced equity. And I think we need to have a conversation around what that means. Because, one, I wholeheartedly agree. Maybe around close to maybe 2 years ago now, we were having a conversation in city council around the disbursement of community development block grant dollars within our city. And there were those who were making an argument that, historically speaking, we had not done so in an equitable manner, meaning Shadyside, Squirrel Hills, Point Breeze, more affluent neighborhoods had received more of their fair share, while The Hill, Beltsville, Manchester, and other communities had not. And so we're debating legislation around how to distribute those funds. And the example was put on the table that if we only have $5 and you have five communities, that historically three of those dollars went to the Squirrel Hill Shadyside, while two of those went to the Hill District, right? And so what needed to occur was that, to make it more equitable, each one of those communities should give one of those dollars, because that was the fair way to distribute those resources. I actually argue something entirely different. I'm of the belief that in order to make this truly equitable, that the Hill District, Beltsville, Lincoln Larimer needs four of those dollars, and Squirrel Hill only needs one. Because the reality is, we have a lot of catching up to do. And until the city, until individuals such as myself, through governmental means, really begin to directly invest in those communities, we won't do what you suggested. We're not going to be the world-class community that we need to be, because we're not going to build up our black middle class. We're not going to truly embrace diversity within in a real way. And ultimately, that will lead to Pittsburgh's detriment. We should be very clear that as cities grow, there is no city in this country that is growing just because white people want to live there. The reality is, when you talk to young people of all races and ages who are looking to move to a city, no matter what poll, what you study, they're always going to say, whether outdoor activities, job opportunities, the arts, whatever it may be, always within top five, diversity comes up as an issue. And right now we have portions within this community where the reality is we have old white men that are dying off, and we actually don't have the workforce ready to replace them. But yet and still, within my community, I've got officially on the books 14% unemployment in the black community. That's the official number. So the unofficial, those who have fallen off or no longer being tracked, now you're closer to 25%. The reality is, we need to begin preparing those people, training those people directly, disproportionately, intentionally investing within them to get them up to speed. Unless we do that, then this city is doomed long term. And I think that's the real conversation that, at least from a governmental standpoint, because that's the sphere that I'm within, that we need to be having. I also think within our own community, we also need to have some conversations. It is very true that we were middle class because of the mills. But at the same time, we were also middle class because of segregation. We also chose to go into business for ourselves. And we chose. So you went into the Hill District community. You had the cleaners. You had the drugstore. You had what you needed, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to receive those goods. I'm of the belief that we also need to look at that. And that is part of my goal, to really begin building up small black businesses, to really look at where are opportunities that exist and how do we take those opportunities, such as the redevelopment of the Lower Hill, in a very real and intentional way, build black wealth. Again, because that's ultimately how this city is going to survive, with all of us prospering. And we need to be very intentional in that effort.
Let's move on to Candy Castleberry Singleton. She is a Chief Inclusion and Diversity Officer at UPMC. I want to start out by asking you about an experience that you might be able to share that might have made you think twice about living here in Pittsburgh?
So as I mentioned, I moved here on a Sunday. I started at UPMC on a Monday. And what I didn't mention is I probably got involved in the community on a Tuesday. And I probably have at least crossed paths with many of you more in my experience in the community than probably in my day job. I went to Berkeley undergrad, so I know how to do a proper protest. But I also started working for Xerox at a time when women were to wear blue suits and skirts, and so I learned how to protest in a blue suit. And I think that all of the experiences that led to me coming to Pittsburgh in my career, as well as the many things that I've done in the community that were more sort of activism related, didn't prepare me for standing outside of an apartment building downtown that wouldn't open the door. And at first you think, and by now I'm doing diversity work, right? You think that the perhaps maybe someone isn't there. Right. So you ring the buzzer the first time and no one answers and you wait a few minutes and you think that perhaps they've stepped away. It was, you know, it was a Saturday. It was late in the afternoon. Perhaps the person had to step away for a break. And so my husband and I, who's also African-American, rang the buzzer about 5 minutes later and no one answered. And at the time, there was a deli next door to the building. So I wrote down the telephone number. And went next door to the deli, and as I'm eating my sandwich, I call the phone number using my inside voice, and I tell them that I'm Candy, and I'm here from Chicago, which was where we were relocating from, and we were very interested in seeing an apartment in their building, and we wanted to know if they were open today, and they said, oh, sure, please come by. So I said, I'll be there in 5 minutes. We're literally right next door. So we go back next door, we ring the buzzer again, and no one answers. And you should know that when there is a buzzer, there is a camera. And so I know that ringing the buzzer, that they know that I'm here. So I pick up the phone, and now I'm using sort of a deeper inside voice. And I say, I just spoke with someone. And they say, oh, ring the buzzer, and we'll let you in. So we go in, and fast forward, we tell them we want to see a two-bedroom. They say they have no two-bedrooms available. They only have one-bedrooms. By now, my husband, who is pretty much an introvert, except for when it comes to me, and knowing that I have that side of me that as my voice gets deeper, my patience is getting lower, and he decides we will see a one-bedroom, even if it's not like the two-bedroom. What they didn't know is that I had a coworker who lived in the building, so I had seen the two bedrooms. And you should know that the two bedrooms weren't much different than the one bedrooms, other than there was no hallway to the second room. So we go back downstairs, we fill out the paperwork, and I ask them how we go about finding out when a two-bedroom comes available. They say, call us on the 6th of the month, because people give us their notice by the 5th of the month, and you should know. We'll let you know. So 6th of the month, I call about 9 o'clock, maybe it's a little after, and they say they took someone off the waiting list. Granted, they'd never told me about the waiting list. And so I go down to the hall and I talk to my colleague who was not African-American, and I express to her my concern because now I'm angry, but I'm in a blue suit in the workplace, so I can't really say what I really want to say. And she calls them. So granted, I call them about a little after 9. About 9:45, they call me back and they had a deal. They had a two-bedroom that they could offer my husband and I. And not only could they offer this two-bedroom to my husband and I, but the two-bedroom had been vacant for 2 months because there was a tenant who had previously moved out whose lease hadn't been fulfilled, but they were still paying rent. I think my first reaction was, why is this happening? And my second reaction was, is this Pittsburgh, right? And a part of me remembered the stories that I'd heard other people tell. Not my stories of my own, but the stories of my parents and my grandparents before. And a part of me was mostly angry and sad that this is the place that I had come to live, but I couldn't live where I wanted to live. And for those who know me, I stay angry and sad for a couple of minutes. And then I create an action plan. And so today, It is my mission to drive what some may know as the Dignity and Respect campaign. Because the thing that I realized in that moment was the thing that was made me feel so sad was there was I wasn't sure why it was happening. I wasn't sure if it was because they didn't think I economically could afford it. I wasn't sure if it was because I was black, although I admit I think that's what I thought it was. But in the end, I was just angry. So we created the Dignity and Respect campaign. And now I tell that story, and they often don't want me to continue to tell that story. What I didn't tell you was where it was, and I won't tell you where it was, but if you ever stand at Bossa Nova and look across the street, you'll see it. Sorry. So, but from what I hear, I know there are a few people who've moved in the building who haven't had that experience. And I'm not suggesting it was because of my experience and my husband's, but I would suggest that I hear that things are different, but we chose not to live there.
When we return, you'll hear more from our panelists and questions from the audience. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and you're listening to a special edition of Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We continue with the audience question and answer portion of our forum on the black middle class. Candy Castleberry Singleton, Chief Inclusion and Diversity Officer at UPMC, started off by talking about why being first-generation middle class is different from the experiences of those who come from an established middle class family.
We have to acknowledge that middle class and black is different in some ways. And what I mean by that is if you're a first generation paid middle class, doesn't mean you live middle class. Because if you're in the first generation, you're taking care of everybody else. So you pay the success tax that comes with being in middle class that prevents you from living middle class, but being paid middle class. And I think I think you have to acknowledge that there is a difference between that first generation middle class. Now, the way that I would say you will know if you are first generation or not is if you can invite your family and your coworkers to the same event. Now, you may laugh, right? But that generally some indication that where you are may not be where everybody else is. And as a result, you are paying the success tax of supporting whether it's a cousin or a sister or a mother or a father. And I hope that you all hear what I'm saying in the best light, because I don't think that we should discount the fact that simply being paid middle class makes you middle class, right? The other is if you're a first generation middle class, you may not have access to the things that will take you to another level because you're the first one to have done a thing. So the first time you have to go to a board meeting or the first time that you have to have people at your house for dinner, when you are first generation middle class, you live a whole different experience on that journey. And sometimes often alone, sometimes you might be the only one in the workplace, and sometimes you don't have another person who is around you, or more importantly, that you can trust that will give you guidance on the kinds of things that you need to do to sustain that, as well as to figure out how to manage all of that that comes with it, which is the success tax.
You know, I did say we were going to go in order, but this next gentleman is a Peabody High School grad. And so we Peabody grads stick together, and Mr. Evan Frazier goes to the front of the line.
So the question is, how do we overcome apathy and resistance to real inclusion in corporate Pittsburgh for African Americans?
I think we have to make corporate America see, feel, and understand that it is in their best interests, and then they have to be very intentional about everything that they do. And then it has to show up on performance appraisals and bonus considerations. Because until the management puts it on the top of their radar screen and says it out loud, then it doesn't become real to everybody else. And what we have to understand is, you know how all of us try to break bad habits? I'm going to stop eating M&Ms. I'm going to walk every day. I'm going to do whatever. Whatever habits you're trying to break or create, it takes a minute. And so until your corporation can start living it, then it becomes an issue. And let me give you an example that I'm very proud of. And I'm very proud of it because I'm talking about Carnegie Mellon University. Jared Cohen, when he came to Pittsburgh, CMU was in trouble. It was in writing that they had a problem. They had issues with diversity with students, staff, administrators, across the board. It wasn't my opinion. It wasn't that you saw it. The people that run colleges and universities said, you have a problem. Jared Cohen came in and said, I am going to handle the diversity issue at Carnegie Mellon University. He'll be the first one to admit he still has a way to go. I'm using him as an example because he took it upon himself as head of that university to tell the university, we are going to address our concerns about the lack of diversity on this campus, and we are going to do it with our heads held high, with strategy, with everybody at the table, and the committee is going to report to me. And then you're going to go out, we're going to develop these strategies, you're going to do your work, we're going to measure it. And then we're going to continue from there. He made it part of the culture of the university. Carnegie Mellon University has been internationally recognized for decades, but now it's even more recognized because of their embrace of diversity and because Jared Cohen was bold enough to take on the kind of position that he needed to take on and responsibility to make change. And so I say that out loud as a Pittsburgh success story. And again, he's not finished, but I really, really like what Carnegie Mellon has done and is continuing to do. As Jared Cohen is stepping down and his predecessor is coming in, and some of us will be saying, hi, my name is, and we want you to know the community wants you to continue this.
I just want to say, as a trustee of CMU and and as someone who is on his diversity advisory committee, I couldn't agree more. I think that his example was exactly the example that we all need to look at. And I think that this whole idea that in Pittsburgh, you know, if you're going to get real diversity and inclusion, you have to be deliberate. You know, it's not just going to happen. You have to be deliberate. So in the absence of being deliberate about it, you know what the result would be.
Well, two other points I want to make, because you mentioned it being in their best interest. And oftentimes when you talk about people's interests, you're talking about their pokebook and what makes allow them to move forward. So when you look at the country, I think we all know and acknowledge that it's really small businesses that are really going to move the country forward. And the reality is women are most likely to actually open up those small businesses than minorities. And so when you're having a conversation around corporate America, I think we need to understand that in doing good business, it's in your fiscal interest to embrace diversity, because ultimately that's going to be most beneficial to your bottom line long term. And then from a governmental perspective, I think we also have to keep in mind, and I'll sort of look at the Lower Hill District, this is something I'm very passionate about, that many of these corporations that will come into cities like Pittsburgh and will be given tax incentives, tax breaks, and certain federal dollars to help build their world-class facilities are actually doing so on the backs, in many instances, of low to moderate income minorities, because that's what allows them to actually get that tax incentive. And so what they need to understand, that while you're directly benefiting from this, because of that benefit, you now need to come behind that and now embrace those individuals and ensure that you're working with them to provide real job opportunities, to provide real opportunities within your corporate structure to now benefit from that. And so part of that is actually, again, up to us. You know, we will put those dollars on the table to ensure that a U.S. Steel stays in downtown Pittsburgh, right? Or we may look to bring a new Fortune 500 company into the Lower Hill as a tenant. But in many instances, they're actually receiving those breaks on the backs of poor people. And so in doing so, they then have a moral and an, I would argue, ethical, legal obligation to now enhance that community, just allowed you to spend less to build your facility. So I think those are also two key issues that we have to keep in mind.
I think that when you look at people's networks, the absence of some diversity exists because of discrimination, but most of it exists because of unconscious favoritism towards people who you like, people who are like you. And so that doesn't sort of, exclude anyone. Faith, oftentimes people pick people of their own faith, people pick people of their own race, people pick people of their own generation, people pick people from their own neighborhoods. And so I would say if we truly want to become more diverse, that we have to challenge our own choices in relationships. Because if we think that I can only have African-American friends or African-American employees, how is that different, right? That I feel equally as obligated to make sure that I understand other people's cultures. Because I can't represent or have passion for something that I almost don't know and I've never experienced. So I think we all have an obligation to diversify our networks. So when I look at your Facebook page, or I look at sort of the little collage of activities where you hang out, that tells a story. It tells a story about a candidate, right, who has one person who's following them around who's African-American. It tells a story about a chief diversity officer who has one person who is not African-American on their team. I think that this is something we all have to do. And by the way, you don't have to be a big leader. You have to be thinking about this in every single thing that we do. So this can't be solely the responsibility of one leader or the leaders of Fortune 500 companies or the leaders of healthcare institutions. This, we all have an opportunity to diversify that. I mean, diversify our own relationships. And if we do, it gives us way more cultural competency than a class that you took, a box that you checked that said, I learned something about the brown people over there or the Hispanic people over there. If you have relationships, it suddenly, I think, enables these conversations to go to places because you care about the people who you're talking about as opposed to a people who you have no connection to at all.
Next question is from Rami Hawkins. There he is.
You know, one point I want to say, Danny hit it on the nose. I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee, and I recently moved up here a year ago. And real quick, I remember an instance where they were building a school, and they had no minorities involved. It was $50 million of government money, and they said, we don't have any minorities, so if you want to get a job, go talk to those boys back here. I went to the mayor, told him what he said. Mayor called emergency meeting. The very next day, everyone was there, and the mayor said, I don't care if I don't have the power to make you use these people, but if you don't have 30% minority participation in 1 week, I'm pulling the contract and I'm giving it to somebody else. It does start at the top. All minority inclusion start at the top. Our rights are not God-given. They're Constitution-given. They're legislative-given, and they're mandated-given. We didn't have rights until they wrote in the Bill of Rights, until all the other rights were given. So the point I want to say is, what is considered middle class here, and why is there such a small middle class? Where I come from, middle class is $85,000 to $100,000. Here it seemed to be less. So what causes it, and what exactly would you consider an income that is worthy to be called middle class?
I'll start because he and I had a conversation before we formally started, and because of course, the theme tonight is around middle class, and everyone from President Barack Obama
to everybody in D.C. and around the country are talking about, let us support the middle class. I said, what really is the middle class? How much do they earn? What are the characteristics? I even had a conversation with an economist yesterday, and I said to this gentleman that I'll repeat now, and if somebody that was fortunate enough to find more detailed information, please share it. But when you refer to the middle class, depending on the economist or the researcher, et cetera, that is at the table and the part of the country that you're in, some people will take the mean of the salary for the metro area that you live in, look at the cost of living, et cetera, and come up with, this is middle class. A friend of mine said he had read something not too long ago that said 41 to 75,000 in this area was middle class. And I couldn't find anything. But the economist also said some people will give you a list and say, if you have a full-time job, you own your own home, you have X amount of dollars in the bank, et cetera, you were considered middle class. As I have been listening to folks on CNN, other places, and reading some articles, many things also relate to that list. I'm a single female head of household. I earn $45,000 a year. I have one child. I lost my house 3 years ago. I thought I was middle class. I think I'm working class now. So my colleagues might have been able to find something more definitive, but the definition of middle class, I was not able to come up with a clear statement about what that is.
And I just have my little caveat, if you first generation, it's way more than that.
Candy said that before, and that's such a critically important point for us to look at as African Americans. 68% of those African Americans that were raised in a middle class family, take whatever definition you want, that were raised in a middle class family, half of them will not stay middle class. They will not be able to get back there. You were raised middle class, but your children are probably not going to be middle class. And it's because so much of our wealth goes back to the home. And if you just lost your house, and the statistics for how many people dropped out of the middle class strictly because of home ownership is scary. And you can take it community by community. And in Pittsburgh, in terms of the number of folks that own their home, is lower than most every other major urban area. So there are a lot of issues here that we have to deal with and address. So even if you don't know the exact numbers or what is the exact definition of things, please understand Pittsburgh has a long way to go in terms of building wealth. There's an article the Urban League refers to a lot that shows the African-American female in the United States has $5 in wealth. $5.
More of our special forum on the Black middle class when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. You're listening to a special edition of the program, a community forum on the Black middle class in Pittsburgh.
We have a few more questions. We're not going to be able to get to all of them. C. Matthew Hawkins.
Many of the people that I knew 15 years ago who have credentials and have experience are no longer here in the city of Pittsburgh because they couldn't find full-time work here. And this is something that Esther spoke to earlier. On a number of levels, and that others on the panel have mentioned. So now my physical friends have become Facebook friends, and in all likelihood, I'll join them soon. And it seems that when there is a perception here, and it's a pretty strong perception based on experience, that when African-American, particularly African-American males in the city of Pittsburgh are competitive with the credentials and with the experience, that their road to full-time employment in Pittsburgh is blocked. And I wonder if you could speak to that, because frequently the focus is on the lack of talent or not being able to keep the talent in the city because people don't want to stay here. But there's a real issue about you can't stay in a city where you can't work.
I do think that, and I know this isn't the silver bullet, but since I've been in Pittsburgh, I've probably seen it more often than any place else. So the statement that the absence of diversity has more to do with unconscious favoritism, I would suggest that what I have seen and observed in the course of my career is people hire their friends. People hire who they know. So I don't know what the answer is specific to your question related to people leaving. But I would say more often than not, we're just not in the networks. When you think about how decisions are really made, the decision is made long before the position is ever available, right? Because they've been grooming somebody, as they should. There's a succession plan, as there should be. And I'm not saying every organization falls into this category, because I can't speak for every organization. But I'm saying that we have to figure out how the process works, and we need to get in every level of the pipeline so that when those pipeline opportunities happen, that there are opportunities to choose people who are different from the people who are making the decisions. These are tough conversations, and I think it's so important to acknowledge that this is where it begins, that if we're not willing to have this conversation with each other, that we will go home and have this conversation and it won't get ever fixed. I mean, you think about it. It started as an article that turned into a broadcast with Evan and Marissa Bartley. And today we're having this conversation. But there's not enough people in this room who will even listen to the broadcast that can solve this problem if we don't decide that this is something we want to fix together. And the other thing that I think we have to do is we have to find ways to lift each other up instead of tear each other down. Because the very same thing that other people do to us, we sometimes do to each other. Well. And so we have to get out of our own way in some ways. And I hope you hear that, like I said, with the best intentions. Because, you know, when you take a chance of sort of being who you are and sharing your thoughts out loud, you take a chance because there are people who will take it out of context, people who will cut a piece of it and turn it into something that wasn't intended for it to be. But I think that the three of us, and I think all of you who could have been someplace else, came here because we believe this is something it's important to do, but we have to do it together. It can't be this half of the room against that half of the room, and it can't be the black people against the white people, or the Jewish people against the Christian people, or the straight people against the gay people. If we really want to fix this, we have to say this is a Pittsburgh community issue, and we as Pittsburghers are really willing to do something about it. And it also means being respectful in those interactions, because when you offend people or get offended, you are not going back to the conversation because you don't have to. So I think even in this conversation, this is not an easy topic. And it won't go away unless we and everybody who hears our voice and this conversation doesn't end today. Esther can't fix it, and the council can't fix it, and the mayor can't fix it. Yes, you are right. They are leaders. They can take a stand. But the thing that happens in the grocery store and the thing that happens at the apartment building are individual interactions with people who make choices to decide that I'm going to treat you fairly and with equality, and I am going to respect you even if I don't believe what you believe. If we can't get to that place, we will be having this conversation, and I imagine this is not the first nor the last time this conversation has happened in Pittsburgh.
I just want to underscore, in total agreement with what Candy is saying, is that it is each and every one of our responsibilities
to influence our circles that we are with and to expand the circle. But we have to do everything in our power individually and on behalf of others that we know to build relationships, to have people trust you, to be interested in you. I disagree with many people a whole lot of the time, and many of them are in powerful, important positions. I get invited back to the table because I know how to disagree with people. I didn't say they're giving me what I want. I at least get invited back to the table so I can try a second time or a third time. Or remember 3 years ago when I came? Are you ready to change now? So I'm just saying, we have to speak up. We have to be persistent. And more than anything, we have to be prepared. So when the opportunity is there, we can go in and it's a slam dunk.
Well, we're down to just the last couple questions here, and we will go with Marissa Bartley.
I think Candy really did touch on what my question was. Conversations are great. We had this conversation in October that turned into a forum, which is great. I was one of those folks that left Pittsburgh as soon as I graduated and went to Chicago and ultimately ended up coming back, and now I consider this home. But I grew up outside of Philadelphia. So what's keeping me on this side of the state? Because you can be a big fish in a small pond in this city if you work it the right way and you make the connections you have to make. But if you want young people to come here, make a life here, create families here, we need to do some work for that to happen. Because just selling, you can have a really good quality of life, doesn't work for the 21 to 39. We have to have more than that. So I think that if you engage in this city, you serve in this city, you get connected, and then you don't want to leave. But you have to serve first.
Thank you.
And the last question, is Jasmine still here? There you are.
The media can oftentimes, well, rarely ever depicts reality, but over time it can wind up shaping reality. Would you all be willing to use your influence to petition our local media to show that there is a black middle class, that there are black professionals, black artists, black entrepreneurs in Pittsburgh doing positive things to shed a positive light in Pittsburgh instead of showing the constant negative view and stereotype that we often see in the media?
I believe I can probably speak for all three of us when I say we have and will continue to do so. That's not a new issue to us, and I believe all three of us have worked on that. However, I'm actually put the question back on to you, because the reality is we're up here as three leaders in our respective fields. And I tell my constituency this all the time. I'm only as good as those that I represent, meaning they have to show up. It's not enough for Councilman Lavelle. They need to hear you. They need to see your voices, your letters. They need to know you're willing to turn the TV off, to not support that programming, to not watch it, to boycott them. They have to feel it in their pocketbook. They have to feel the public pressure, and that can't just come from us, because what I will tell you is over time, they'll go, well, that's Esther being Esther. Well, that's the councilman just fussing about what he's always fussing about. That's Candy concerned about blacks again. It has to come from others, not just us.
And on that note, I'm afraid that we are out of time, but we appreciate all of the questions, even those that we didn't get to. And we especially appreciate the participation of our panelists tonight. And once again, I'd like to acknowledge them. And then at the end, when I've mentioned all of their names, please give them a nice round of applause. Award-winning journalist Ben Schmidt, Esther Bush, president of the Urban League of Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh City Councilman R. Daniel Lavelle, and Candy Castleberry Singleton, Chief Inclusion and Diversity Officer at UPMC. Thank you, all of you, for your participation.
This has been a special edition of Essential Pittsburgh, a community forum on the black middle class in Pittsburgh, recorded before a live audience at the 90.5 WESA studios. The program was produced by Marcus Charleston, assistant producer Heather McLean, Production assistance provided by Rebecca Zook. Our engineer was Russ Lloyd. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thank you for listening.